Welcome to Preaching and Preachers, a weekly podcast devoted to those who preach and to the task of preaching itself. I'm your host, Jason Allen, president of Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. Today, I want to welcome Dr. Mark Coppinger to the podcast. Dr. Coppinger serves as professor of Christian philosophy and ethics at Southern Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. In addition to teaching at Southern Seminary, he also is managing editor of the online Kairos Journal. Before his current post, he served a stint for 4 years from 1995 to 99 as president of Midwestern Seminary. So Dr. Coppinger, it's a delight to have you back on campus.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Well, welcome to Preaching and Preachers.
Thanks.
We've had such a wonderful day and yesterday with you already, and the opportunity to host you and your wife for dinner, for Karen and I to do that, and then the presentation and chapel this morning and conversation with the faculty. It's just been a really encouraging 24 hours to me, and I look forward to the rest of the day and to having you back in chapel tomorrow.
Thanks. I do. We treasure our time here, and you've made us feel so welcome. This is, and just a lot of old friends. I mean, it's just wonderful to be back here. And we love Kansas City. We love Midwestern, and it's just a dream to be back.
Well, it's an honor for me to have you here. And you and I overlap for a number of years at Southern Seminary, chronologically speaking, but I never had you in class as a professor, so we weren't particularly close, but we would chat occasionally and visit. And so to get to have you here and get to know you kind of on this side of the table, have you on campus here, hear you present, has just been thoroughly rewarding for me and enjoyable. And have you on the podcast where we talk with different people week in and week out about some aspect of preaching, typically, or more broadly, pastoral ministry or leadership. But today we're talking about preaching. Especially, we're going to be focusing on preaching as apologetics. And this is in your wheelhouse. You are an apologist. You're an ethicist. You're a philosopher. You think in these categories. You speak in these categories. And you devoted your life now in your public ministry for over four decades into engaging these topics in the public realm. So I guess before we get into kind of the specifics of the conversation, just more broadly setting the stage, I'm curious how you became an apologist.
Well, you know, my dad taught philosophy and religion. He basically taught religion, but they were tapping some of those religion professors at Belmont, Carson Newman, and Ouachita to do some philosophy courses now and then. And so he took a few summer courses at University of Colorado Boulder and George Washington University and different places and sort of tuned it up, but it was his second thing. But anyway, I majored under him. I majored in philosophy. And philosophy, a lot of philosophy, religion, you know, you're dealing with skeptics and so forth. And somehow, I don't know, it took root, and I ended up wanting to go to grad school in philosophy. So I went to Vanderbilt, got the doctorate there, and, you know, you're doing a lot of things in philosophy that are not apologetics, I mean, a variety of things. But, you know, if you're a Christian and you're in the company of David Hume and Bertrand Russell and all kinds of other folks, you're fighting for your faith's life, and so it's just part of the thing. So, yeah, so a PhD in philosophy, you're in the mix. And so I taught at Wheaton a number of years, and that's how you get it in your bones.
Yeah, I guess in the 21st century, to be a Christian, a growing Christian, is to be an apologist, at least to some degree. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, no, that's true. You know, it's funny. A lot of the older philosophers were working in a day when it was understood that God was on his throne and Christ was his son and the Bible was true. And so you have philosophers who, like Thomas Aquinas or Augustine or Pascal or Leibniz and so forth, and then, you know, things changed a bit, and then all of a sudden the skeptics are running the store, and so you have names, like I mentioned, like Bertrand Russell and A.J. Ayer and so forth. The funny thing is, when I was in grad school in the in the 70s, it was a war. It was between the guys who believed and the guys who didn't believe, and so they were throwing whatever they could at us, and we were doing our best to defend it. And then a funny thing came along, postmodernism, which is really relativism. And these guys are saying, no, that's good, that's your truth, and this is our truth, and you're not beat up as much, but you think, but wait, I kind of like the old way, because we actually were disputing over something and not just having, like, power struggles, like whose narrative is going to, because there's no meta-narrative, it's just this, you know, partisan group versus this partisan group. And so when the old guys came back, the Chris Hitchens and the Daniel Dennett's and the Dawkins and so forth, it's kind of like, okay, game on again. You know, this is fun because at least they believe we're wrong. It's not their, you know, they're not like indulging us like, well, if they get you through the night, you know. So it's been a fun time. But there was a day when the guys who were skeptics, they had to hide out instead of us. In fact, the name heathen and the name pagan, they basically mean hick. Because Christianity came to the cities, like the cities of Revelation or whatever, Antioch and Jerusalem, and the guys who were like worshiping cats and howling at the moon were out in the sticks. they were the Pagani out in the state, or out on the heath in England. So they were the outcasts. In recent days, and the Christians have been more the outcast in philosophy. So, yeah, it's a strange time.
So I am 40 years old and came of age as a kid kind of in the 80s and into the 1990s. And for me as a teenager, as an adolescent in the church, and then I became a believer my freshman year in college and began to explore Christian ministry and seek to patch together. You know, I didn't think of it then as a worldview, but that's what really what I was doing, seeking to patch together how I should view the world, how Christianity intersected with the world. Well, as a kid, as a teenager, and then as a college student, at that point in time, it seemed to me in the 80s and then into the 90s, again, this is me processing things as a teenager, but it seemed to me apologetics was like an event. Apologetics mm-hmm. was a person. Apologetics was a resource. And by that I mean this. It would show up in my church life or in, you know, kind of the city I'm from, Mobile, Alabama, at some kind of workshop or event or local church conference, and kind of expert X, who typically, you know, was an evidentialist, would come to town, and oftentimes it would be kind of like a Josh McDowell type person with resources like his book, Evidence, you know, The Demands of Verdict.
Right.
And to kind of show up to a church and kind of present arguments for Christianity, you know, the proof of the resurrection, the veracity of Scripture, what have you. And then, you know, he kind of get on the plane and fly elsewhere. And I'm not criticizing that at all. That helped many believers, including me. But as I track this thing, it seems that the apologetic task has morphed, and helpfully so, has morphed beyond, you know, a person or a workshop or an event or a speaker or a book into, by necessity, more of a way of life for the local church, for believers in the local church, and for the pastor ultimately himself. I'm curious, you know, do you resonate with my observation? How would you track our times the past several decades?
Yeah, you know, I think you're right. I think it's a both-and thing. I remember when I taught at Vanderbilt, the Campus Crusade folks brought Josh McDowell to campus. I had him in my class, but it was a big emphasis. And then when I was at Northwestern working in student ministry, William Lane Craig came to campus. So those were good events, but, you know, it's a little bit like mass evangelism. It's great to have crusades and this Billy Graham sort of thing, and I really cherish those. But there's lifestyle evangelism, too, where you're prepared to give an answer for the hope that lies within you, or give an answer to sort of take the stinger a little bit out of somebody's jab. And the more you read in this area, the more you have these things that are just, they're just at hand. The proofs are interesting things. I mean, you know, we have all these proofs, traditional proofs for God's existence, the ontological, cosmological, teleological, moral, I would argue the aesthetic, that's one that I use sometimes. But, you know, it's not as though you really prove these things solidly, like, boy, if we could just get a better version of the cosmological argument, then we can sing Just As I Am and everybody would come to the Lord. I'm persuaded that the main reason people don't become Christians is they don't want God as a boss. I mean, it's not a matter of the intellect, like, man, I'm almost there. Can you refine that proof? Can you give me a little more evidence? And then I'll come into the kingdom. It's like, you know, whatever. I just don't want anybody ruling my life. And so, As a pastor in a college town in Evanston, Illinois, with Northwestern, they would come to me with these questions from the dorm, and they would say, oh, you know, someone says, you know, God invented the whole world knowing that most people go to hell. How can we do this and this? And I would sit down, and we would talk about these things. But in terms of, like, sharpshooting proofs, not so much. I think that more and more people are working toward an appreciation of what's called IBE, inference to the best explanation. That is, I can't do a knockdown proof. You can't do one. But what's the account that makes things hang together better? What's the picture of the world that seems to make the most sense? And I think that we can. It's almost like intelligent design too. We can win that. I mean, it's just. Now I will say this in the pulpit. You know, I don't like. Okay, guys, here's our proof for the week or something like this. But you can anticipate. Like, you'll come to a difficult passage. And they love to find those things, and they'll take a jab at this, like, oh, see, you know, there's the Canaanite genocide or the this or that. And when you come across them, then you could just say, well, now here's an answer, and here's this, and the problem of evil, you have the soul-making theodicy or the, you know, free will defense or what have you. And I just did these things as an aside, not so much to equip them to go out and be like warriors in this, but to say, don't come all in glue to somebody throws this. There are thousands of years of people working on this kind
right.
of thing, you know. But just let them know the resources are there and there's some answers. And that's one thing you do.
Well, I appreciate your lectures here this morning. You said it a number of times. And I remember when I had philosophy in seminary, Dr. Ted Cable, one of your colleagues. I remember him saying, making the exact same point, that when someone throws one of these arguments at you, one of these criticisms, take a deep breath. This is not novel. It's been answered by intelligent Christians, and there are good answers there. Now, I want to go back to the Josh McDowell, the book, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And that was kind of a generational defining book.
And by the way, his son, Sean, got a PhD from us at Southern.
That's right. That's right. You know, as I think of the preacher in the 21st century, it's you know, I think of the task of the preacher, you know, it's not the book Evidence That Demands a Verdict, but it's really questions that are demanding answers. And when you think of the preacher himself, you know, who are we preaching to on any given Sunday? And of course, let's say in the 90s, there's a lot of emphasis on being aware of, you're preaching to seekers. Well, and that's a whole other category, you know, God is the seeker, not man. But if there's one condition of people that we're preaching to that are lost, that are fallen, that do not know Christ, it's most likely we're preaching to doubters. Would you agree?
Yeah. You know, it's hard to know how many of them are just, you know, they have a crusty front about them, but, you know, how many are secretly thinking, please break through my crust, or how many of them are just infernally committed against God. You know, one thing that the power is the word. And so you have no idea how just the simple preaching of the word will impact people. God uses that. There was a book called, a famous book called God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, by Chris Hitchens. And he goes chapter by chapter talking about how religion does terrible things and the like. One of the strongest ways, I think, that you can do apologetics is just to come back and say, look at all the wonderful things that God has done. And you can give illustrations of transformed lives and awakenings and upheavals and revivals and restorations and the like. And I think that that is an answer. That's a kind of apologetic, talking about the church glorious. And so I like to just salt in all kinds of illustrations about how this particular revival turned this town upside down, or how this fellow is going one direction and the like. That's apologetics too, because it says to Chris Hitchens, no, God really is great, and where his people move in, then where his spirit moves in and his people move in, wonderful things happen. I do think it's nice to give people a kind of reference library, just drop some notions here and here and here, and they'll think, look, I don't know what that proof is. I don't know who that guy is, but I know a guy who knows something. And so you almost put a buffet line of your competencies out there just in passing. And so, you know, you could just say, you know, well, so-and-so, okay, Bousma did this, or G.K. Chesterton said that, or now Lewis in his Humanitarian Theory of Punishment or Mere Christianity. And it may be that 95% of the people say, whatever, whatever, you know. But this one guy said, what was that guy, you know? And I think that one of the most important things we can do at seminary and in our Christian life is do our homework so that we know what's in the library. So a guy could come and say, yeah, I know about this guy. I heard about him, but I know where to find it, and I know such and such. And some of it is from Josh McDowell. I mean, you know, he'll say something about the prophecies and how they link up, or, you know, Chesterton might say something. I mean, here's a simple example. C.S. Lewis said in Mere Christianity that, you know, people look at this person and say, he's a Christian, and look how badly he behaves. And look at Gandhi or something like that. Look how wonderful he was. So it doesn't matter. And just in a paragraph, Lewis says, wait a second, that's not the way you do it. You say, what would this guy, Christian, be if he weren't a Christian? I mean, if you think he's like scurrilous now, just imagine if he weren't saved. And then, like, imagine what Gandhi could have been if he'd been a Christian. So those little things are just incredibly useful.
So the preacher as apologist, is it right and helpful and appropriate for the preacher to self-conceptualize himself as an apologist?
Yeah. You know, if it's like a Wednesday night prayer meeting or a Sunday evening service and it's just the family gathered, I mean, you might have one person, but you don't retailor the service to make it apologetic thing for this skeptic. I mean, you do your prayer meeting and let him see the living church alive. But you remember Dan DeWitt at Southern, he was working with a group by the Louisville campus, and they set up with the Atheist Society a debate between me and an atheistical philosophy professor at Louisville, and the topic was, can we be good without God? And I think there were a couple hundred people there. Well, I went in knowing exactly what we were doing there, and it wasn't like a deep Bible study on tithing or something. I mean, we were getting after it, you know. So, yeah, I do think that, I mean, one thing I love to do as a pastor was to preach books. And, I mean, God bless people who do series on everything from marriage to prayer to finances to what have you. But I just love to go through Matthew or Timothy or Jeremiah or something, and it's just amazing how everything turns up when you do that. You know, like, why did you preach on that? Well, it was next, you right. know? And I've got this little project. I did a seminary talk, and I'm kind of working into a book project where I show that every one of the 25 words in John 3:16 in the King James Bible gets pushback from the culture, including the four that starts. I mean, I have to explain, but one group will come after that. So no matter how seemingly warm and benign a verse is, it has enemies and gainsayers at every point. And so you don't have to think like, okay, I've got to somehow rather go to this text to do my apologetic thing. Just about anything, as an aside, you can say, well, you know, God gave his only son. Now, there are people who don't like that it's a son, or, you know, I mean, and then you could talk a little bit about that. But the Bible in the history of the church is under siege, literally at every word. And so you always have an opportunity, particularly if you sense that the people are anxious about a doctrine or about, I mean, obviously, if you're talking about something like kill every living thing in the city of Ai or Jericho, like, well, whoa, that was God, you know. Well, it's good to talk with him. That came up at the Louisville thing, and I was talking about a kind of, they call it prophylactic mastectomy, where they will go ahead, if there are markers, gene markers, among all the women in this family for breast cancer, then sometimes they go ahead and you're like, what did you just do? I mean, well, yikes. I mean, they didn't have cancer or whatever. But if you know the whole backstory, you say, oh, I get it. Well, when God does something that's shocking, you say, he's got the whole backstory. He knows the whole thing. You can use analogies, and I don't mean everybody just fell away and said, oh, I've got it. But you use what we can, and use what you can, and it's amazing. You can do it at every turn.
You know, you mentioned John 3:16 and the pushback. Every one of those words gets. And just to be clear, what I am proposing and advocating and what you're suggesting as well, it's not that the pastor's sermon should become, you know, a weekly handout
right.
of charts and graphs exactly. and answers and questions. But rather the point is that as you preach and you're bringing the truth to bear, you're exposing God's word. That in and of itself is an apologetic work.
Yes.
So we need to do it wisely, biblically,
right.
Intentionally.
Right.
I often talk to students and interact with people, and they're reflecting on the culture, and they say something like this, and this especially is showing up in kind of what I refer to as lowercase e evangelicalism, not robust capital E evangelicalism that's conventional, but the lowercase e that has a really, really squishy line as to where does the evangelicalism end and the liberalism begin. But the lowercase e evangelicalism, you'll hear the argument something like this, well, if we tone down, you know, cultural issues, if we tone down marriage, if we tone down sexuality, if we tone down gender, if we tone down abortion, well, that might make Christianity more palatable. But it won't, because if you hold to the gospel, and you've already alluded to this a few minutes ago, the teaching of the exclusivity of the Christ, of the exclusivity of Christ, that one must repent of their sins and believe in the Lord Jesus Christ to be saved, and there is no salvation apart from him. I mean, that right. is the most offensive doctrine that one
can
utter.
I know. It's a fool's game. I mean, I actually had an atheist friend in grad school who was talking about the Unitarians who just kind of vague everything out, and he said, why bother? I mean, if it gets to that point, why bother? And even in grad school, there was a book called Why Conservative Churches Are Growing, and it's like, you'd think the
Dean
Big Ten. Dean Kelly. You think the Big Ten, everything laid back and everybody'd flock there, and he says just the opposite because it doesn't seem to be serious. No, it's the thing I talked in chapel today about Edge, that it gives it power. And I think people are hungry for something that has real punch and edge to it, like, wow, now this is something to give my life to. And then I think just the Holy Spirit shows up when you preach the word fairly, and there's a power beyond your reasoning and cleverness for sure. But yeah, I think it's a terrible mistake people make, and there's a kind of longing for it. Like I remember I preached on hell once, and this lady said, I have been in this church 20 years, I've never heard that, thank you. Now, you don't want to do that every Sunday,
right.
but there's a hunger for the punch of the Bible.
Sure, that's right. Now, so we've talked about this from different angles, you know, why apologetics, the fact that the preacher really is an apologist, whether he realizes it or not. So let's say we're talking to pastors in this conversation, they're listening to us and they're saying, okay, I want to be more faithful. I want to be more intentional in my preaching. how would you encourage them? How would you counsel them to strengthen their game in this regard?
Boy, I would love to preach. I would love for them to preach books to just acquaint themselves, to force themselves. I heard this this exchange at Vanderbilt. One of the professors asked another professor, "Do you know Sanskrit? That is the language." And he said, "No, I haven't taught it yet," which just seems backwards. I mean, it's like, oh, I studied, and then I taught it. And say, well, no, that's really how it works, that you don't learn it until you take it on yourself. So I would say craft sermons, on your own, fresh sermons, dig in. I used to get a variety of commentaries. At first, I would read the Bible and then write all these questions, bombard it with questions, and put impressions. And the commentaries would be almost like, I would imagine they were people. And they're sitting around the table and say, can we talk? You know, what is hyssop anyway? Or, you know, or something right. like that. And so you get counsel, but you have that encounter. And then I think that by reading and by experience, the world is just alive with illustrations. And I kept finding myself again and again marveling that someone would actually pay me to spend hours each week studying the Bible to talk about it. It's like, what's the hitch here? It is one of the great privileges. And yet I've known pastors who they don't have a heart to dig or something, and they're always looking for, you know, do something else on the side. And I think just delightfully getting into the Word. And you end up asking yourself questions like, if I were a skeptic and I came to this, like, here's this passage, and like, wait, that doesn't sound right. Or here's an imprecatory psalm, like, that sounds a little creepy. You know, I wish that their kids would be dashed against rocks. If you just sail on and say, oh, well, deal with it, it's in the Bible, well, then you're really shortchanging yourself and the people. So when there's a genuine question, you think, man, I got to figure out what's going on here. And again, just working through the text, fresh text, week after week, you're going to have a game on all the time. And also, I just think it's great fun. There's so many resources out there. I mean, the church wasn't invented last week, and they've been working on this for years.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, I have five young children, and a number of years ago we were considering homeschooling. I remember talking to Kara now and saying something like this, you know, well, if we homeschool, I wonder if there's any curriculum out there. And, you know, getting on the internet and looking and thinking, there is an ocean of resources. Yeah. The challenge is not that there isn't curriculum. The challenge is, how will I spend all these hours sifting through what's available to find out what we actually want to use?
It was this
revelation for me to encounter. Yeah. It's the same way about Bible difficulties, whether it's, you know, the old Gleason Archer book,
yeah,
Bible difficulties,
sure,
or so many other. I mean, again, you go to your website, it's just there. And given the proliferation of resources, the embarrassment of riches we have, there just is no excuse not to have good answers to honest questions.
Right, exactly. And even if you don't, even if you haven't internalized the answers, or you can't pull the rabbit out of the hat yourself, just the fact that you are staying up with that, you know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody, and you say, I can get back to you on that, and it's there. And I mean, I get calls, of course, as a seminary prof, like, oh, I'm dealing with this thing, what do you say? But they're online, they're in books. It's just crazy busy. We, working with Kairos Journal and Bible Mesh, we've discovered that there are parts of the world that do not have these riches, do not have the translations in. And so I had a great joy just going to Southeast Asia a couple of years ago in a little Bible college there and just do apologetics. And they're like drinking out of a fire hose. I mean, they're just writing stuff down. Wait, slow down. What's that? Whereas our guys are sort of, my colleagues like yawn. Yeah, I've heard about that argument. I've heard about the watch and Paley and stuff like that. But a lot of the world doesn't know what's out there. So it's really fun to just offer things. We have our website actually translated, and I think it's seven languages. And we have a following in America, but it's gone crazy in China. And
wow.
So the world is really eating up apologetics.
And that is Kairos?
KairosJournal.org.
KairosJournal.org.
Right. For ministers, yeah. It's free.
Well, listen, thank you for the conversation today and for coming to Kansas City and being with us and to serving the seminary community. And to those who are listening, preaching as apologetics, my desire, as is Dr. Coppinger's, is not to layer on another level of expectation or burden you have to carry weekly, but it's simply to realize as you are preaching, you are doing apologetics, and to embolden you in that work and encourage you and say, look, there are more resources out there than you can count. And so avail yourself to those and press on the good work. Dr. Coppinger, thank you for being with me.
Thanks, Dr. Allen.
Thank you for listening to Preaching and Preachers. For more information, please visit my website, jasonkallen.com.